It was not unusual in an America of a few decades ago for religious leaders to say there was no place for the faithful in politics. That has changed in a very big way, as have many other elements of life in the United States since the Second World War. Kenneth L. Woodward gives us a comprehensive overview of that landscape in his book, Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics, from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. Kenneth Woodward is a journalist and a scholar, not necessarily in that order. He spent nearly four decades as the religion editor at Newsweek. His reporting took him to the far corners of the world. Kenneth is also the author of previous books on Catholic saints and miracles in several religions. Kenneth Woodward, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Glad to be with you.
So about the time I took up your book, we got the news about the Alabama Chief Justice being removed from office a second time for putting religion above the law. Is Roy Moore an example of the trends you're writing about in the book, or is he a bit of an outlier?
Oh, I would say he's an outlier. His period I am looking at is pretty unusual, and we haven't seen anything like what transpired in the second half of the 20th century, since the middle of the 19th century, which was the Second Great Awakening, and it was the rise of Mormonism and Adventism, and it was a sunburst of religious energy and enthusiasm. And the same thing happened in the second half of the 20th century, although a lot of the energy and enthusiasm went off in directions, as you know, the young kids sought religion, but anything but what the religion of their mother and father. So you saw Hinduism and Buddhism come on the scene. You saw alternatives to religion, transpersonal psychology being one, and we can talk about that in a bit. It was pretty exciting. So it was an exciting place to be at Newsweek to watch all this happening.
So do you regard what happened in the latter half of the 20th century as a third Great Awakening? Was it that notable?
Well, you know, that's interesting you mentioned that, because Francis Fukuyama, I think it was, you don't think of him talking about religion, but I think he's the one that said, yes, this is a third Great Awakening. But you could play on the word awakening because, of course, that's what Buddhism is about, awakening to the real. Your real conditioning. Well, conditioning too. Yes, there was, but I prefer energy and enthusiasm and the image of the sunburst because it bursts out in all directions, and a lot of it peters out after a while. There were, for example, in the 1980s, about 300. New religions, they called them. A lot of them were cults, Unification Church, the people that in Jonestown that drank the
Kool-Aid. People's Temple, yeah.
Look what happened at Waco and all of that. There was a very strange period, and we don't hear about that anymore, and I think, thank goodness. But just looking at the fact that in the 80s, and a certain amount in the late 70s, a million kids a year ran away from home. And, you know, this wasn't Huck Finn going on the raft down the Mississippi. These were college freshmen and sophomores. They were juniors and seniors in high school from wealthy families, a lot of them Jewish. They were, in many cases, victims of, of broken homes. And found themselves in the arms of what I call, in my book, sacred families. And Dr. and Mrs. Moon were one of them. And so what was happening to the family, and therefore to the young, was intimately related to the rise of these new cults as family replacements. And what I've just told you is an example of what I try to do in the book, which is relate religion to cultural, political, and social events.
And two major trends you note right up front. One is the departure from traditional religion we've been talking a bit about so far. The other one, great use of term, by the way, the exfoliation of religion since the 50s. Meaning what?
Well, again, the sunburst image comes up. Exfoliating, meaning there's a lot of stirred up religious interest, and suddenly it sort of bursts forth. I'll give you another example that I talk about in the book, but if you recall the drug culture of the 60s on campus, And then the vogue of LSD and other hallucinogenic drugs. This has a history that goes back all the way probably to the 20s or 30s in some places in the country, mainly Southern California. And then suddenly you get interest in, oh, Timothy Leary is a good example of going from one to the other. But you get interest in meditation and other ways of feeling that the self, rather than the family, the self is sacred. And you could feel that tripping on LSD, and now a lot of people were doing it without the drugs. So there's an intimate connection between the rise of the drug culture, which I didn't know, it didn't exist when I was a kid, to the interest in Hindu and Asian religions.
You witnessed much of this history in person. What got you to write the book?
Well, I can give you several answers. Some are more honest than the others, but I certainly was motivated thinking my grandchildren would never know what life was like then unless I told the stories. And I had stories to tell, which is when you have them, you want to write them down. I wanted them to know, and my children, what a rollicking good time their father and grandfather had. But I wanted to rescue those times, and I wanted to make some arguments. And one of the arguments I make is, for lack of a better term, the natural superiority of the 50s over the 60s, for example. Because the image of the 50s, as I looked at it and I did my research, the image of the 50s as conformist and dull and all was created pretty much by 60s people whose understanding of the 50s was something they got from television.
Okay, let's hold it there for a second and come back after this break. The book is called Getting Religion. Kenneth Woodward, the former religion editor at Newsweek, its author, our guest. And we'll come back and talk more with Kenneth and talk to you as well on the phone and by email when we return to The Exchange in a minute five. REM seemed appropriate here as we talk about religion with Kenneth L. Woodward, the former religion editor at Newsweek. He's written a big book called Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. You're more than welcome to join this conversation. Maybe tell us a story of your own getting or losing of religion since mid-century America. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you're just talking about the 50s. You start off in chapter two of the book by saying we Americans can never quite let go of the 1950s, but we do seem to think of it as a time of conformity, and you resist that notion.
Well, I mean, first of all, it saw the dawn of the greatest literary generation we had in the 20th century, and one of all time. I mean, this was John Updike coming along. Philip Roth started out then. Flannery O'Connor came into her own. Cheever was a little bit earlier, but his novels were there. Norman Mailer was another. We haven't seen anything like this. There are some interesting statistics here. In the 50s, more people went to classical music recitals than went to baseball games.
Really?
When I graduated from college, T.S. Eliot had come over, and the great poet, and gave a lecture at the University of Minnesota. They had a hold in a gym because the 15,000 people turned out. 15 million out of 165 million Americans listened every Sunday to the Metropolitan Opera out of New York on radio. We could go up and down. The New York School of Painting, which really finally said, we don't have to look to Europe for the avant-garde. The avant-garde has arrived here. That happened in the 50s. Civil rights movement started in the 50s. I could go all the way up and down the line. So the idea of conformity, I think, is kind of crazy. It was, after all, the time of the Cold War, and people pulled together. So, I resist that notion altogether. But those things have not been matched since then. And I think it's time that we, in a sense, gave the 50s its due.
Well, and one thing in particular that comes back to the main point of the book, which is it was really a high watermark for church attendance, it would appear.
Yeah, no question. No question. I mean, we weren't a very religious country in the beginning. There's a lot of mythology about that. But certainly the 1950s was the high point in American history of religious behavior, belief, belonging. And there were more churches, synagogues built in the 50s than any time before or since. And people filled them. The culture supported religion in the sense that we were fighting atheistic communism. One of the things I discovered, by the way, when I was doing the research, is when Eisenhower was running for a second term, the Republican National Committee declared, it was on the front page of the Times, the New York Times, that Mr. Eisenhower was not only the president of all the people of America, not only the commander-in-chief of all the armed forces, but the spiritual leader of our country. Now, when you think back to George Bush Jr., who liked to talk about his... he would mention Jesus in his and religion, not much more often though than Clinton did, actually, Bill Clinton. There were books written about we were about to enter an American theocracy. Nothing compared to the 50s. I would just add so that being religious, acting and going to church, synagogue, whatever. Was culturally supported in a way that it hasn't been since and may never be again, for that matter, because it was almost too much. It was very convenient to be religious, and it was very American. Adlai Stevens was, as a Unitarian, if I remember correctly, was perceived as maybe not quite right for the office of president because he wasn't more of a traditional Christian.
Kenneth Woodward's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. So church attendance at a high watermark, it was more or less expected. But when I think about the exfoliation that you write about in the book, I use that at a real literal sort of sense of as the sloughing off of outer layers of people who weren't that committed. So do we have perhaps a smaller percentage of people are religious now, but they feel it more fervently or are more pious?
No. I've thought about this a lot. I would, my guess, and this is backed up on polling data, and the man who's really good at this is political scientist John Green at the University of Akron, and the people at the Pew Institute. I would say that at most 25% of American adults put religion at or somewhere near the center of their lives. And so that it matters to them. Now, I'm not talking about Mother Teresa's here. I'm just talking about ordinary folk who see themselves as sons and daughters of God, who try to behave accordingly, and who try to, and join together as in worship on a weekend and so forth. I'm not talking about Dorothy Day. I'm not talking about some of the extraordinary people that we saw in the second half of the 20th century. So I think that's pretty much it. But also the culture doesn't support it. I can't explain why. I can give you an example. I did a lot of book reviews for the Sunday New York Times while I was at Newsweek, and they had one editor there who was a House intellectual. He was a Rhodes Scholar, and he was religious. And he would, and when he died, they didn't review books anymore about religion. I suppose I'll see mine in there. I hope I do, but I expect to. But the paper doesn't really cover religion. It's as if it didn't exist. And remember, I was 40 years, my wife and I, living in New York and raising a family there. So that's something of a standard, that newspaper. So I don't think, look, I could go on about this. I would put it this way. We are so busy working, so busy making it. Anything that pulls away from, you know, self-advancement and so forth there isn't time for it anymore. That's part of it. You don't realize. I watch my kids, and other people's kids, and they work longer hours. They have to. I'd hate to tell you what it was like at Newsweek, but I mean, in some days, it was just a more relaxed world than what we have now. And religion belongs to the relaxed side of the world, in a sense. You have to step off the pedal a little bit to take in the deeper view.
We are talking about religion in America through the context of Kenneth L. Woodward's book, Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. You're more than welcome to join this discussion with your own story of participation in religion or not, or its effect on you in America today or in previous decades. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome back to The Exchange with Kenneth Woodward.
Good morning. Absolutely fascinating topic, and looks like another book that I'm going to wind up reading. I'm going to wind up hating you, Jeff. I've got quite a stack here from your current callers. I've got David Daly's book in hand right now.
It's a worthy stack.
In any event, and I am calling it Rat Forked.
Thank you.
In any event, I do have a question regarding religion and American politics. How powerful a force was religion in forming the idea of manifest destiny in the 19th and 20th centuries and American exceptionalism in the 21st centuries? Was it central to that, or was it just a tool used as window dressing to fulfill a political and economic agenda?
Okay, good question for that. Thanks for that.
Well, you're going farther back than my book does, but I will address it. I think so. The city on a hill. You know, a lot of our, for lack of a better term, mythology. I don't mean to sound true. I mean it's the myth making of what it is and America is and who Americans are, going back to Plymouth Rock and all of that. They were escaping the corrupt European world, and God had preserved. This was the feeling, the American continent, for them to create a society worthy of God Himself, and this. So they, there was that sense right in the beginning, and it warred, of course, with our Enlightenment, the American Enlightenment, which is something different. That's very much a part of our heritage. But that early myth was there, and furthermore, put in historical reality. There were Spanish Catholics coming up from Mexico and moving along California, and the Protestant East very much did not want to see the Catholics capture any piece of this country. So there was that sense, this has been set aside by God. That would be going back as far as I can with the notion of American exceptionalism. And I think the other thing was the second half of the 19th century, the sense that there was extraordinary effort put into American missionaries, spreading, you know, back to Europe, spreading the true gospel. So there's a missionary aspect to American foreign policy, and it even gets this, even if you drop the religion from it, you still get it in forms of spreading democracy around the world. Is that really our job? A lot of presidents have thought so.
So is it a religious fervor that drives those kinds of things?
Well, you can certainly get a religious fervor behind efforts that are not primarily or inherently religious. That's a discussion I have in the chapter of my book on what I call movement religion. Let me explain that for a moment. Most people get religion from the family, the neighborhood, you know, and they practice it in the neighborhood. You get up here in the Midwest, you know, you're either Lutheran or Catholic if you live in Wisconsin. That's an exaggeration, but it was largely true 50 years ago. But the other way of getting religion that happens beginning with the Civil Rights Movement in the 50s is it's quite the opposite. It doesn't matter if you're a Unitarian, you know, from Massachusetts, or a Catholic from Milwaukee, or an Episcopalian from Delaware. What matters is you're part of the movement. So where you come from and what your, let's say, denominational or religious identity is doesn't matter so much as that you are with us in the movement. And yes, the Civil Rights Movement under King came out of the black church, but that idea of movement religion continued. And so we saw the women's movement, which was, the leaders were not religious at all, but it had that kind of sense of moving with history and justice is being served and all of that. And you saw it then in the gay movement, and until finally, if you weren't in a movement of any kind, and you weren't really being very socially conscious.
And you also list the anti-war movement, liberation theology, and the evangelical Pentecostal movement.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Some of the things like consciousness raising, it's never been acknowledged by the women's movement leadership, but that was really inherited from Latin America and liberation theology. I have chapters on the Berrigans and Rabbi Heschel, who's a dear, dear friend of mine, taught me Judaism and much, much more. And conservative, like Richard John Newhouse, who moved from left to right. Those are other ways in which religion is connected to public life, political, social. So it's not the matter of, it's not always institutionalized in churches. It can be institutionalized in movements. We can't forget Billy Graham and the whole rise of the evangelicals. They weren't on the scene when I was growing up. They weren't even much on the scene when I went to Newsweek in 1964. They really didn't come on the scene until two Catholics and a Jew looked around for somebody to counter the Jimmy Carter and the Southern Evangelicals and Southern Baptists who supported him. And they picked out Jerry Falwell, and they called his movement Moral Majority. People very often don't know that. Jerry Falwell didn't do it himself. Wow. And they became a part of the Republican Party. They weren't there before because they were quiescent when it came to politics, even to voting in many cases. So politically what happens is, I guess, after 1972, the conservative wing of the Democratic Party disappears and the liberal wing of the Republican Party disappears, and you've got two ideologically opposite political parties right now. That's what we're seeing. And there are other ways of relating religion to politics, and one of them is what I call and I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal about this, Democrats' Methodist moment. And it goes from McGovern, who was son of a Methodist preacher, studied to be a minister himself, went to a Methodist college, grew up in a Methodist manse. And when you look at the Democratic platform of 1972, which was done, of course, by Senator McGovern, and largely influencing it, when you look at the same year the Book of Resolution of the Methodist Church was, you see in some cases the party platform, which came 3 months later, was word for word with the Methodist handbook had to say. So that's a coincidence, but I do look at it in this way. And Hillary Clinton you have a woman who was formed by that Latter-day Methodist social action perspective. I call it righteous politics, and it's both a good side and a bad side. We're righteous. You don't look how we're standing with the transgendered, et cetera, et cetera. We're liberating them. We're removing the stigma or whatever they say they're doing. That's one side of it. And the other side of it is the arrogant side of it. We know what's good for you. That attitude comes again, I think, from Hillary Clinton. And these are the ways that religion influences, because I have looked at all the 20th century presidents, and I cannot for the life of me draw a connection between the real or at least stated religious convictions, denominational loyalties, etc., of presidents in any single domestic or foreign policy initiative. None
okay.
whatsoever.
No lines to be drawn there. We're talking to Kenneth Woodward about his book, Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower in the Era to the Era of Obama. You're more than welcome to join us. We have a couple of calls waiting. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Kenneth Woodward and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about religion in America and how profound the changes it has gone through, as has America, since the 1950s. Kenneth Woodward is our guest. His book is called Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Age of Obama. He came of age in the Eisenhower administration in the mid-50s and documents the changes since that time. He spent nearly 40 years as the religion editor at Newsweek, so we have the benefit of that experience as well. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to Donna in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kenneth Woodward.
Yes, I'd like to see if I can be short. I went through a lot of the movements, 50s, 60s, 70s, and on, and I'm up almost 88. And one of the big things that I saw was people were searching. They were I'm nervous.
That's okay.
They were discontent with the rote, the convention.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, exploration. So there was a lot of searching, and there was a lot of ecumenical, at least in rural areas, cohesion, including with Catholics. There were nuns studying Buddhism, coming to Bible study. There was, in the 50s, I picked up a pamphlet in the Episcopal Church about the charismatic movement in South America, which was quite remarkable and triggered my interest. And there was a big growing charismatic movement that was really quite healthy until it seemed to evolve into legalism and fundamentalism, some mm-hmm. of it. But also some of the leaders like Pope John and the Catholic Renewal and some of the...
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you are of the right age to have witnessed enormous change, and I would describe the basic structure of that change as the following. Before then, people got religion, that's my title. As I said, religion was embedded in the landscape. Where you lived made a difference, and people lived in neighborhoods. It came most often through communally, through your environment, if you will, and that meant boundaries between religious groups. I argue early in the book that the greatest source of diversity in the 50s, which I take to be a 20-year period from the end of the World War in 45 to Lyndon Johnson sending numbers of troops to Vietnam in 65. There were boundaries, and in the South there were more Baptists, it seemed, than there were people. And the boundaries were this connection between religion and ethnicity. And even within the Catholic Church, the Polish Catholics didn't always talk to the Irish Catholics. They had their own parishes. Anyhow, those boundaries begin to dissolve. And it's too long a story to talk about it now, but part of it's intermarriage, of course, but part of it is the media. When people went to, I used Columbia University, when Jack Kerouac rode on the road, right, the Beat Generation, when he went to Columbia from Lowell, Massachusetts, and the Beat poet, who wrote Howl, help me here, came over from New Jersey, and Willie Morris, the editor at Harper's, came up from Mississippi. They came from different cultures. They were really different people. Kids going to college today have all watched the same television, done pretty much the same things, are more alike than different. So we're not as diverse anymore. When diversity becomes a big deal because one person's a man and another's a woman and one's straight and one's gay, that's not as culturally diverse as it was in when people came where from places where people talked different, ate different, didn't see people from other regions. The collapse of those boundaries and the homogenization that really took place with when television took off is also part of the story I'm telling.
Another call here from Rick and Eugene. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange with Kenneth Woodward, the author of Getting Religion.
Hi there. I, too, am getting along in years. And I did my high school years and started college in the 50s and 60s. And I was born in 1942. So I experienced the 50s in great detail. And I found them to be extremely repressive and unpleasant and not simply rewritten by the people in the 60s. I hated the 50s. It's just that at the time, I didn't know there was any other possibility out there. So I felt completely resigned to a miserable existence, to be very frank. And I was raised in an upper middle class family, plenty of money, exclusive neighborhood, had plenty of contact with other kinds of people. So I was well traveled, well experienced, and I just found the rigidity drove me mad. And by the time the 60s came along, and I define the 60s very much as you do. I don't, the first part of the 60s was essentially the 50s. The 60s
right.
Began in 1966, 67, 68, as I define them. And when this huge upheaval occurred in the 60s, by that time I was working in the film business, and so I was out on my own in my mid-20s, and I got to experience it from the position of a young man who was still young enough to be almost a teenager, but old enough to have some real functionality in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I was delighted that it was happening, and I met some of the people who, the Beat people, Gary Snyder and that whole group, you know, and got to know what the Beats had been about.
Okay, let's give Kenneth a chance to get in here. All right, thanks for that, Rick. Appreciate it.
Well, we always, I'm just counting up, if he was born in 42, in 63 he'd be 21. And he's right, the 60 begin in 65. It depends. Obviously, I mean, you've just graduated from college, if you've gone to college and so forth, and that's when we're feeling at one with our generation, and you see a lot of things changing. See, he experienced the 50s when he was very, very young, and I wouldn't want to use up your radio time, but you have to find out why your caller or anybody else felt that things were rigid and felt that, I mean, if you were gay and you certainly would have felt oppression. If you were black, you would have felt that you were, oppressed. So there could be a lot of reasons for this sort of thing.
Somebody
or
else had
you
that.
Just simply liked, I happen to think On the Road is a boring book. I was excited when it came out, but I was a young man then, and I couldn't pick it up now and read it. But I can pick up Saul Bellow still and read him. Mm-hmm. There's a difference.
Well, you know, the difference in how you felt the 50s as oppressive or not certainly could have a lot to do with who you were and the circumstances in which you grew up. I mean, you lived in Omaha, and you talk about apartheid existing in Omaha when you lived there.
Yeah, but on the funny way, it was exciting. Well, here's a paradox. Yeah, and this can get me in trouble, but I think it's true, and I've seen a little book called Lost City is a perfect example of it. If you're not, don't have a stomach for irony and paradox, you're never going to be able to think about history. And we had, starting in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, we had in Kansas City, we had in New Orleans, and other places in the South, this bursting of a music called jazz, the quintessentially American form of music. These came out of places where we might call them ghettos. Well, they sure were, out of American apartheid, because, and what happened in this is that African Americans, whether they were poor or middle class or had the few who had reached the stage of something like richness, okay, all lived together. They created a culture. They created forms of music, among other things. They created black politics, too, which got used by people like Mayor Daley in Chicago later on and so forth. When American apartheid softened to the point where middle-class of African-Americans could move out to other places, who got left behind? The poor did. So you don't have, coming out of the black neighborhoods of Chicago and so forth, you have gangs. You don't have, you know, music being stirred. Things aren't happening in the way. So the irony is that once the gates to the surrounding the ghettos were lifted, the people who could escaped, and there was a kind of cultural dispersal, and never quite the same vibrancy as it was before.
Other interconnections with religion and the civil rights movement. I'm curious to know if the civil rights movement, if you think it scared or otherwise drove some whites out of the mainstream Protestant churches.
Oh, yeah, that's a, yeah, just a lot. All I could say is read my book. There were a lot of things that happened there at the time. And yeah, a lot of the clergy, especially after Selma, which I wrote about extensively, the clergy joined it. It was a matter of conscience. They were being prophetic, and so forth. And a lot of the laity, you know, weren't prepared for that. And there was a certain amount of moral arrogance on the part of the clergy. On the other hand, they were right. And there was, a lot of people, especially in Protestant Christianity, where the congregation is more important. The Catholics have a slightly different structure. They can identify with the Pope and so forth. It's not just their immediate congregation. People didn't like associating a church not only with people of a different color, but people who weren't their same economic status. And there was a lot of resistance. There's no question about it.
When we get to evangelicalism, you say that it's entrepreneurial in its theology.
Yeah, I give it a different definition because it really is. It goes all the way back to the start of capitalism and evangelical religion, which is what Protestantism was in Britain. That would be the foundation for it all. Yeah, it's evangelical Christianity is really, this is not a theological definition, it's a social definition, is really for enterprise and religion. When a guy like Jerry Falwell comes out of seminary, he doesn't, like a Methodist or a Presbyterian, become a junior pastor in an established church. No, 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 no. You're thrown out on your own. You start your own church. So he went to an old bottling factory and started preaching. And then as you see your congregation building, and they're building through your voice and your words, then you see that, so the story goes, that God is blessing you. And because it's obvious that you are being successful. And so there is that connection. And I spent a lot of time with Billy Graham, and I knew him well, tell stories about him. But one time I went out to do a cover story on him, and we were riding around the car in Los Angeles going to his office out there. I had just met him personally for the first time. He gets out of the car and opens up his wallet, and I mean, there's no reason to do this other than he was proud of it. Shows me a card with the name Billy Graham, you know, in raised letters in Boston there. Billy Graham, World Evangelist. It's for Marriott Motels. And he says, Willard Marriott, or J. Willard Marriott, the owner of it all, the guy that started it, gave this to me and allowed me to stay for free at any Marriott hotel in the world. Well, I come from a family of salesmen, my two brothers, my father. I know what it's like. I know what I knew what Willie Loman was like. They liked their perks. And in that sense, Billy was a platform performer, is the way I would put it, and a good one, and an effective one. But he was also a salesman, and he created an organization. The numbers are boggling. I don't translate the millions and tens of millions of dollars they raised and spent into today's currency, today's dollars. But it was huge and sophisticated. But all of it was to allow, and that's a part of entrepreneurial religion. Mm-hmm. How do you know you're successful?
All right.
The numbers.
And late in the book, and late in his life, Billy Graham said he used to play God, is what he told Kenneth Woodward, which is one of many things contained in the book, Getting Religion, Faith, Culture, and Politics from the Age of Eisenhower to the Era of Obama. Kenneth Woodward, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Show.
Thank you for having me. It was a real pleasure, and thank you to the people that called in.
All right, take care.